So gay marriage is one big case in front of the Supreme Court right now. Another case before the court involves race-conscious admissions at the university level, affirmative action, what form it should take, and whether it should even exist. 8 states have already scrapped affirmative action altogether, including California, and that has affected admissions policies at state schools there. This morning, we're going to spend some time at the University of California, Los Angeles. The change at UCLA has been messy, ambiguous, and sometimes a little ugly. California banned affirmative action in 1996, and that, of course, meant UCLA and other California state schools could not consider the race of its applicants. After that happened, the percentages of Black and Latino students at UCLA started to fall fast. 2006 was a turning point. That year, only 96 out of nearly 5,000 freshmen were African American.
Hi, I'm Corey Matthews, part of the infamous 96 freshman class 2006.
Corey Matthews told us there were protests on campus and a lot of news coverage, and all of it changed how people talked to him.
You know, in conversation, oh, you're one of the 96, the infamous 96, what's that like? Or do you all know each other? And do you all live like in the same area? There was this mystery around who we were and what we were doing on campus.
And Matthew says it is a big campus.
Tons of student organizations, tons of sports, thousands and thousands of people, huge lecture halls, 250, 300 students, group projects, discussion sections. And still in all of those, you are most likely the only African-American student.
UCLA realized there was a problem pretty quickly, so it decided to start something called holistic review, which essentially meant taking into consideration a wide range of factors all at once, from GPA to family income to whether you were the first in your family to go to college. Race was not one of the factors, but the goal was to make UCLA a more diverse campus, and it worked. Black and Latino student percentages began to go back up. But then last year, things got complicated again when one of UCLA's own professors put out a study. So what was the reaction on campus to the study?
Well, the reaction was not pretty.
That's James Berrigan, who just graduated from UCLA, and he was the editor-in-chief of the school's newspaper, The Daily Bruin. Berrigan says the study claimed that UCLA was letting some Black and Latino students in at higher rates than white or Asian students who should have ranked just the same. In other words, the study claimed UCLA was breaking the law, admitting solely based on race, essentially reverting back to affirmative action. The Daily Bruin published a news story on the study, but it also ran an opinion piece suggesting that the school reevaluate its admissions policy. That sparked a lot of anger on campus. Here's Berrigan again.
I think we thought we were prepared, but it was kind of hell when it all broke loose. Some student groups held a rally outside of Daily Bruin. People were saying that the paper was a rag.
All day, people kept coming out to me asking if I'd read the Daily Bruin, if I'd seen the article. The words, minorities constitute an undue percentage of the freshman class, just kept floating around in my head. Undue percentage? It felt like a slap in the face.
It was.
And they actually asked me to come speak. And I got up there and spoke, and people were yelling at me. I got a long email the next day calling me an embarrassment to my race because I wasn't supporting the cause.
We should say you have a Latino background, is that right?
I do have a Latino background, yes. So just things like that, and I got a lot of interruptions while I was speaking, just yelling shame, shame.
That must have been hard.
Yeah, especially because it was a lot of students that I had known previously in the years before, and it was the same folks that, you know, were patting me on the back the previous year for exposing the truth out there, and then 1 year later calling me a shame and calling the newspaper that I was running a shame.
Did you expect any of this backlash?
Yeah, we knew it was coming. You know, obviously everybody wants more African-American students and Latino students so that we can have a more diverse campus, including myself. The issue was that we feared at the paper, once we saw the study, that this diversity was coming at a cost of other students who were also qualified to be there and maybe weren't getting the same opportunity.
For its part, UCLA and a number of professors there dispute the legitimacy of last year's study. A school spokesperson told us that UCLA's admissions policy is legal, fair, and equitable. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on affirmative action this week. If they strike it down, a lot of schools around the country could wind up facing the same dilemma UCLA has dealt with for nearly two decades. If I said, let's listen to some Norwegian music, what sounds might be conjured up in your mind? Maybe some electronica, maybe some obscure rock. But I am willing to bet you probably didn't imagine this. This is Jarle Bernhoft, a Norwegian singer-songwriter, and this is a song called So Many Faces off his album Ceramic City Chronicles. It was a departure for Bernhoft. Back in 2005, he was known for a very different sound. He was in a hard rock band. It was sort of like Norway's Foo Fighters. But Bernhoft had this nagging feeling that he wanted to make a totally different kind of music.
This friend of mine gave me a Sly and the Family Stone album, and it's just, I couldn't really come down off that wall. I was nailed to it. There was a profound need to try and do something in that vein.
Since then, Bernhoft has been living in that vein. And recently, he stopped by our Washington studios to play some songs for us.
I got the big city blues. I don't want to stick around. And I know that she knows. I got the big city blues. I don't want to stick around. And I know that she knows. This here is so concrete. And I miss my little town. And I know. She knows, she knows. I miss the houses, I miss the streets. I'm gonna miss all the people that greet me with a smile.
Thank you.
That was amazing. And for people who might not know this, that big textured sound, that's just you. We're in the studio right now with a whole lot of equipment. Can you walk us through what's happening here?
Yeah, it's basically it's a setup where I can record stuff. So it goes into this cable. It goes through a pedal that says squash, and a pedal that says wah, 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 and one other goes roo, roo. And then it goes into this recording device that I can, like, if you're hearing this, and the trick is to not get into chaos.
Controlled chaos.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Well, let's listen to another song, if you don't mind.
All right.
We're going to hear Come On Talk.
Yeah. Come on and talk to me. I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me. I will try my utmost to be rhythmical. Try to be. Come on and talk to me. I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me. I will try my utmost to be rhythmical. Try to be. Come on and talk to me. I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be rhythmical. Try to be. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be rhythmical. Try to be. Come on and talk. Thinking a lot since the end of our family affair, about the things that went wrong in a matter of speaking. I should have been more forthcoming about the things I needed to say. You seem to be talking to someone else. Come on, come on and talk to me. Talk to me, yeah. Matters most in the end is beyond our fickle reach. How to unfold all the mysteries? It takes a different kind of species. I'm unable to handle the weight of all of your clouds put into words. Now you
got me feeling so stupid. And when I couldn't understand, you got me reeling round in circles, incomprehensible to me. Come on, talk to me, 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 yeah, to me, yeah. Come on, talk to me, yeah, to me.
That was great. I'm going to date myself here, but for people who grew up in the late 70s, 80s, that would be me. You may be younger than I am, but beatboxing was huge. And at the top of that song, when you're laying down those fundamentals and those riffs and those sounds, I mean, that's just fun. That's like stuff you did as a kid, making all kinds of weird sounds. And now it's, you put them together and these textures become something really vibrant.
I guess that's a big part of it. Yeah, just playing around and stuff. And because I get bored very easily, actually, seeing solo performers, because they might do the same trick over and over. Mm-hmm. When I was through with exploring the guitar, I needed to, you know, synthesizers and stuff like that. And doing beatboxing as well was just something that I didn't think I could do. But then, well, hey, the hell with that. Let's just try it.
Why didn't you think it was something you could do?
Because in many ways, I'm a very modest person. We're getting deep now, aren't we?
Well, I wonder what you're saying. There's something about beatboxing that...
No, I didn't see myself as a beatboxer. I still don't, actually. But at the same time, it's just... I think I'm a musical person and I understand rhythm. Uh-huh. And I understand singing. So beatboxing is just... It's a part of that.
You are between albums at the moment, I understand?
Yeah.
And what's happening for you musically now? Are you going to stay in this vein for a while?
I probably need to stay in this vein for many reasons. It's like felt coming into my own in many ways. I don't think I can ever get out of this kind of soul music. It's never going to leave me, I think.
Jarle Bernhoft, he is a Norwegian multi-instrumentalist. He's also a songwriter. He joined us here in our studios in Washington. Thanks so much for coming by. It's been so fun to talk with you.
Likewise.
Well, can you play us out on another song?
I'll do.
Let's hear Come Around With Me.
Yeah.
Come around with me. Come around with me.
That'll get your Sunday off to a good start. If you'd like to hear more music from Bernhoft, go to nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
Come around with me. Come around with me.
In August of 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. gave the legendary address known as the I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. But that was not the first time King had spoken of his dream of equality and brotherhood between the races or an end to the violence and the battle for civil rights. As part of our series on the summer of 1963, NPR's Allison Keyes visited Detroit. 50 years ago today, King gave a speech there that addressed many of those themes quite differently.
We want all of our rights. We want them here and we want them now.
The throng of people gathered in and around Detroit's Cobo Hall clapped and shouted as King spoke at one of the nation's largest civil rights demonstrations on June 23, 1963.
I have a dream this afternoon that one day...
Organizers of the Walk to Freedom wanted to speak out against the brutality faced by civil rights activists in the South. They also wanted to address the inequities in jobs, housing, and education faced by blacks in the North. King's speech dealt with it all.
One day little white children and little Negro children will be able to join hands as brothers and sisters. I have a dream this afternoon.
The speech given by Martin Luther King Jr. in Detroit may sound familiar to those who have heard his speech in August that year at the March on Washington. But the Detroit speech was tailored especially for this city with a long history of civil rights activism.
And one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job.
This speech, given just 2 weeks after the assassination of NAACP Mississippi Field Secretary Medgar Evers, is more pointed in its message.
Before the victory is won, some, like Medgar Evers, may have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children and their white brothers from an eternal psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive.
I was just turned 14. And, of course, hadn't seen a crowd like that in my life. And it was just thrilling.
Gloria Mills was there that day as more than 125,000 people flowed down Woodward Avenue. She looks out at the street from a Starbucks that stands near the beginning of the route and remembers the dense crowd marching toward Cobo Arena.
I can still feel the chills from listening to that man speak because the timing and then his leadership, we just knew that we were on the precipice of something very, very important.
Lonnie Bunch, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, says Martin Luther King Jr. had given a similar speech in Newark, New Jersey, in January of 1963.
Often, King would try out themes.
Bunch says King knew it was critical to have the right tone, and King knew the rhythm he wanted and the story he wanted to tell by the time it came to the March on Washington.
While there's something wonderful about imagining as if it sprung whole from the head of Zeus, it really is part of a long month's work and study to get it just right.
At the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, African American history professor Stephen Ward says people shouldn't think of King's speech in Detroit as a preview of his words at the March on Washington.
I don't see it as the same speech. I think he was giving a speech for each context.
Ward notes that the Detroit speech comes right after major events in the battle for civil rights, including President Kennedy's address supporting civil rights legislation. The Washington, D.C. speech came in a climate where organizers didn't want to do anything to make it more difficult for Kennedy and his allies.
In D.C., he's speaking to a national audience in the nation's capital, trying to push for the civil rights legislation. In Detroit, he's speaking to a Detroit audience where civil rights legislation had always been a goal, but its realization, its materiality is different at that point.
Ward says, like many preachers and civil rights activists, King would use some of the same language and ideas in different places. And he believes the way most people call the Washington address the I Have a Dream speech limits how they think of it.
No, it was his March on Washington speech, which included the I Have a Dream oration and idea, which he gave at least in Detroit, probably a few other places, because those were things that he was thinking about and he was communicating and sharing.
When do we want justice?
When do we want it?
Now!
The NAACP in Detroit co-sponsored a 50th anniversary celebration of the Walk to Freedom. President Wendell Anthony says it was about trying to continue King's work against issues including voter suppression and racism that continue to plague his city.
Dr. King was about bringing folk together. So the fact that we leave him on the mountaintop dreaming is our fault. He wouldn't want to be there. He wants to be back down in the valley working.
Allison Keys, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Most of us are willing to share certain things about our lives with our friends on Facebook or followers on Twitter. But the NSA scandal has got us all thinking more these days about who else we might be inadvertently sharing our emails and phone calls with. And we're all vaguely aware that commercial websites collect data about us, but how much? And should we be worried about this? If you've been thinking harder about your own privacy in the digital age, you are most certainly not alone, and you have help. That's the good news. NPR's Steve Henn is here in studio. Welcome to the show, Steve.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so people share more information than they're aware of.
Right. And I think, you know, obviously when you post on Facebook, you know you're sharing information. But I think sometimes people don't realize how much information you're sharing. So, you know, one of the ways this happens is when you share a picture. And maybe the best way to demonstrate this is to show you this picture that my wife sent me.
Yeah.
I've just dropped it into an app, and there are lots of apps like this available. And you can see all the information attached to it, including latitude and longitude. If I just click this button, it shows you on a map exactly where that picture was taken. And if we zoom in,
wow,
it will actually show you the building and where in the building it was. I mean,
that is amazing. Yeah, I don't think people realize.
So all of this information gets stored. And if you email a picture to a friend or post it on a social network, a lot of that can be out there and easily accessible.
So that happens every time you take a picture, that specific data is cataloged.
Right. Unless you go into your phone and turn the location services information on your camera off, which you have to know a little bit to do. But most people, I think, don't do it. You know, I have an 11-year-old daughter and lots of her friends are getting cameras. Recently, a friend took a picture of her and that came up. And these are all tech-savvy kids. You know, in Silicon Valley, a lot of their parents are in this industry, including Nico Sell, the co-founder of a company called Wicker. I spoke to her recently about her own daughter, who's about the same age as mine.
She posted a picture that she didn't consider dangerous up on Instagram, but it was a picture of our dog at our house that was geotagged.
And that innocuous picture basically makes it possible to track down Nico's daughter at home. That geotag, that little bit of metadata attached to the picture, shows where it was taken. And today, all smartphones and most cameras add those tags automatically, you know, and it's like writing your address in the back of a photo.
Yeah, that's scary to me as a parent, but just as a person, that's disconcerting.
Right.
So all of this means that people who aren't nearly as tech savvy as Nico Sell's daughter are probably making mistakes all the time.
Right. We're all leaving digital footprints all over the place, and most of us don't realize we're doing it. Because of that experience, Nico, who's an entrepreneur and really involved in computer security, built an app called Wicker that would make it a little bit easier for people to take more control over their digital lives.
Okay.
Okay. So I just sent you a little video of my kids singing happy birthday.
All right. So I'm going to log into Wicker. Oh, look, Steve Henn has sent me a message.
When you touch that message, it actually decrypts the message on your phone.
Okay, tap to unlock.
Uh-huh. And then you can just touch it and play.
Happy birthday!
Oh, it's very cute.
The thing that's kind of cool about this is you can set a time limit for how long that message will last on your phone. So instead of creating these permanent digital records where you're leaving all of this data about yourself behind and you don't even know what it is, it puts the user in a position of control where they get to decide how long something is shared for.
But it does require some more effort. I mean, do you have, in your reporting, especially living in Silicon Valley, are people really using this to streamline all of their online communication?
No. I think depending on how sensitive you are to your own privacy, it's helpful to know that tools like this are out there. One of the things that's interesting about this one is it makes it a little bit easier to use. Perhaps over time, as we continue to have conversations about privacy like this, we'll see more attention in Silicon Valley about making tools available that are easy to use that also allow you to control how your information is shared.
I feel safer already. Thank you so much. NPR's Steve Henn.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here.
If I went to a conference, the chairman, and he always was a chairman, would always start off, "Good morning, gentlemen. Mrs. Shirley," as I was then, because I was the only one in and I was really breaking new ground. And of course, it does have advantages. At least people remembered me.
This is Stephanie Shirley, Dame Stephanie Shirley, actually. She started a computer software company called FI back in 1962 with around $10 in her pocket. Over the years, she turned it into a multi-million dollar company, something quite extraordinary for a woman in business at the time. Now at age 79, she has stepped away from the business world to focus on philanthropy. She's donated around $100 million to various causes. That distance has given her perspective on her remarkable journey, how she struggled to balance work and family before the very notion even existed. Dame Stephanie Shirley is our Sunday conversation.
It was a company of women, a company for women, and structured in a totally new way, with women working from their own homes, with the only technology in those days really was the telephone. And our application forms actually sort of said, do you have access to a telephone? I mean, those were different days. And at the time, software was given away free with the hardware. So people laughed at me. They laughed because you can't sell software. It's given away as part of the deal for the computer. But you can't be serious about being in business, because women at that time were really focused on home and domestic responsibilities.
So you took it upon yourself. You said, I want to create a different kind of business model. What were you seeing around you in British society at that time that made you think that this was necessary?
Well, a lot of women were joining the embryonic computer industry, because we needed mathematics to work in the industry in those days. And women were coming out of the universities with decent maths degrees. And they were then, as was the culture, leaving professional activities on marriage, or occasionally they went on working on after marriage until their first child was expected. And this was a tremendous waste for the industry, but also impoverished women's lives, because there's something very positive about pursuing an active business career, and software was just wonderful for us.
Am I right in reading that you actually ended up having to change your name in order to be taken a little more legitimately?
Well, you asked about the sort of problems that one had, and one that I never measured in scientific terms was that people were not replying to my letters. And eventually, my dear husband of now over 50 years suggested that it was because I was writing under this sort of double feminine, Stephanie Shirley, Shirley being my marital name, and suggested that I abbreviated to the family nickname of Steve, Steve Shirley. So it's still alliterative. And it seemed to me that we were beginning to get some responses. And although there was a sort of frisson as I walked through the door, I did have a good story to tell. And, you know, business started to take off. So I've been Steve ever since, and I'm very happy if you call me Steve.
Oh, well, thank you. I shall. Was there anything that happened along the way that made you second-guess your choices to try to go off and break new ground for women in this particular industry? Did someone ever mistreat you or put your business back a few steps as a result of your gender? Or was it all just kind of at the surface? Just, there's a woman, what's this lady doing here?
I'm not really sure, Rachel. Obviously, I did hit the glass ceiling. I decided to, as many women have done, to build an organization that was appropriate for our gender, that gave flexibility of working, that didn't have this macho command and control style of management, but was much more concerned with team working, and we can do a project, you can help me this morning, I'll help you this afternoon. Really a very different style of organization.
Do you think those policies that you push, those family-friendly work schedules and culture, did that have an impact on other businesses? Did that change the way other employers thought about women in the business world?
I've always been very disappointed that there were so few companies actually emulated my own, which was totally home-based, totally female-friendly.
You were a mother yourself. Your son Giles was diagnosed with autism as a toddler. And for any working parent, balancing family and a job is a struggle regardless, but that must have been incredibly difficult.
I found that the only time I forgot work was when I was with my Gilesy, and the only time I forgot Giles was when I was at work. So for many, many years, it balanced fairly reasonably. But there is a high cost of, I think, a vigorous professional career, and childbearing and child rearing is really part of that culture. And eventually, I burnt out and I broke down. And there are costs to pay, which some people are not prepared to make those sacrifices. I look back and say I wouldn't have had it any different. I'm much more sensitive to other people's stress levels, having broken down myself. And I did eventually come back at full strength.
What was happening when you say you had a breakdown? What was the tipping point?
My son was getting more and more difficult, and he was coming up for 13, and puberty hits most of us with difficulty, if you think back of how it was. Giles couldn't cope with it at all, and after several relatively calm years, he really became very distraught, very disturbed, violent at times, and it all got too much for me, and I ceased to function at all.
Did you walk away from your business at that time? Did you just say, I need to stop?
Yes, I'd organized a sabbatical of 3 months because I knew I was overwrought. And what happened was that they managed very well without me, which might have upset me. But that is when you build an organization, it has to be more than just me. And so as I was developing management, I think of myself, Rachel, as a sort of gardener. I grow organizations, I grow people. I've grown not only my company, but four independent charities, which are now totally freestanding. They don't depend on me for management or for financing. And that's what I do. And it is this business of doing new things, making new things happen, and learning myself.
There has been a lot of talk here in the United States about the idea of family work balance. An article came out in a magazine, The Atlantic magazine, a few months ago called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And in it, the author, Anne-Marie Slaughter, talked about how even though she had reached the top of her field in the upper echelons of the U.S. government, she couldn't make it work as a mother of two teenage boys. And I wonder, is this just the way things are, that a woman is going to have to make a decision about how much of her energy she's going to put into work and how much energy she's going to put into raising a family? Or does society have some responsibility to bear in creating structures, creating systems like you did in your business to make those choices less difficult?
Well, certainly in Europe, work has become much more flexible. We talk about flexi-work, we talk about telework, work at a distance. Many, many corporate people work one day a week at home. Well, that's 20%, isn't it? So that things have changed. And the idea that I can say, look, I don't want a meeting on Wednesday afternoon because it's school sports day, is now acceptable. Whereas at one time, women would not even say that they were married, yet alone had children, in case it was considered that they were not 100% behind their professional career.
Dame Stephanie Shirley, she joined us from the BBC in London. Her book, Let It Go, is available now on Kindle. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Do you think women inevitably have to sacrifice professional success to have a family? That is this week's Sunday Conversation question. We want to know what you think. Tell us on our Facebook page, NPR's Weekend Edition, or on Twitter. I am at RachelNPR. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. 150 years ago, West Virginia became the 35th state in the Union. Born in the middle of the Civil War in 1863, the state was created by patriots who didn't want to join the Confederacy. No mean feat, considering the political climate of the time. So as West Virginians celebrate their sesquicentennial, yes, that is a real word, we are joined by Joe Geiger. He's the director of the West Virginia State Archives. Mr. Geiger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy West Virginia State birthday.
Thank you so much. We're we're real excited to celebrate our 150th anniversary as a state.
So for those of us who weren't paying that much attention in school, remind us exactly how and why West Virginia came about.
Well, largely because of the Civil War. I firmly believe that without the Civil War, we wouldn't have a West Virginia. Western Virginians believed that they didn't get enough funding from an Eastern-dominated legislature for internal improvements for education, things like this. And also the economy was different in Western Virginia in terms of slaves. Only 4% of Virginia's slaves were in present-day West Virginia. So you would naturally assume that there was an opposition to slavery in Western Virginia, and indeed there was, but this was largely due to economic and political reasons, not moral ones. Essentially what happens is the government of Virginia, when they secede from the United States of America, it leaves that government vacant. And what these folks do in Wheeling, these people who are so determined to remain loyal to the Union, is they try to find a way to deal with this. And the first thing that they do is create a union government, a replacement government for Virginia. And in the end, this is going to be the key to West Virginia statehood, because according to the Constitution, in order for a new state to be created from an existing state, that existing state has to give its permission.
For people who've never been to West Virginia, what are West Virginians like?
Well, it's West Virginia is the kind of state where you walk down the street and you speak to every person that you see. You make eye contact, you smile, and I understand that if you did that in New York, you might be looked at a little strangely. So people care about one another. They take care of each other. We've had certainly different disasters and tragedies in our history, and the first thing that you see in response is West Virginians banding together to help one another.
Joe Geiger is the director of the West Virginia State Archives. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.